Chapter 15, the last chapter of the book, Facing the Future Wisely. Perilously persistent cargoism. It is essential to see the profound peril in today's flagrant misperception of the very nature of the human situation. That peril compelled me to write this book. Misperception is the problem to be overcome by a paradigm shift, and only a paradigm shift can overcome it. Misperception will tend to motivate efforts to pursue ostensible solutions, quote-unquote, that will, when the circumstances are so much different from what people suppose them to be, make matters worse instead of better. In this concluding chapter, therefore, I want to highlight the contrast between prevalent presuppositions about our situation and about our options and the actual ecological circumstances that need to be recognized and with which we must do our best to cope. During the debate on energy policy, one ominous sign of the prevalence of mistaken assumptions was the fact that cargoist expectations could pass for realism. As we saw in Chapter 4, realism and cargoism are importantly different. This difference has been obscured during public debate by exaggeration of a lesser difference between cargoist expectations that tech fixes will overcome the problems, and the more exuberant former expectation that problems would naturally vanish with the passage of time. In referring to cargoist thought ways, I am not now merely speaking of particular technological proposals, of domestic solar water heaters or other soft energy paths, of the breeder reactor, stepped-up oil exploration, better carburetors or smaller cars, gasification of coal, geothermal power generation, etc. At this point, I have in mind the general background belief that carrying capacity can always be raised anew by further technological breakthroughs. As we saw in Chapter 2, major technological achievements did in past ages repeatedly raise the ceiling for human population. Modern cargoism naively supposes this picture of the past must also be a valid picture of the future. It may not be. In Figure 1, he's got three figures here, three images of growth. In Figure 1, three images are compared. Image A schematically depicts a curve of exponential growth in a situation where there is no ceiling. That image represents the expectations nurtured by the age of exuberance. Only an outright ostrich can hold that view of the human situation today. Image B, if taken as a picture of the past, shows that image A was once plausible because the ceiling sometimes was raised before the growth curve had quite bumped against it. The cargoist way of thinking takes image B as a picture of the future. Image C, a schematic way of reflecting the fact that prosthetic man's resource appetite has grown larger and larger, shows that carrying capacity can be considered a diminishing quantity rather than an ever-enlargeable quantity. Technological advance can reduce carrying capacity, even if historically their function was to raise it. Image C is much more different than image B, is much more different from image B than the latter is from image A. Insofar as image C is applicable to mankind's situation in the real world of post-exuberant times, then image B is not sufficiently more realistic than image A in serving to chart our way into a post-exuberant future. Despite this, there are persistent temptations toward cargoist thinking. By the time the 39th President of the United States implored his countrymen to devote themselves to, quote, the moral equivalent of war, unquote, to meet the challenge of living in a post-exuberant world, to tax themselves in ways that might begin to foster energy conservation, and by the time he urged Congress to enact various efficiency-promoting policies, other developments were already beginning to provide excuses for supposed crash, would be averted. Hope continued to spring from anticipation of new ways to accelerate drawdown. Oil companies, styling themselves as energy companies, as they diversified their holdings and their entrepreneurial activities, filled the media with ads extolling technological breakthroughs to come. Americans would beat the Arabs at their own game. If the Arabs happened to be sitting on top of the world's largest remaining oil reserves, America had more than that much energy under its own land in the form of coal. The ad writers glowingly told the viewers, the viewing and reading public, about new ways being devised to dig it up faster and burn it better. Coal would be liquefied, gasified, piped in one form or another to where we wanted it. And then he has in parentheses, the need for vast quantities of water to do this and the scarcity of water in some areas where much of the strip mining was going to occur were not mentioned in the ads, nor was the inescapably dead-end nature of the drawdown method ever acknowledged amid cargoist rhetoric and imagery. Excuses were available internationally for thinking along cargoist lines. European nations had faced a serious emergency at the time of the 1973 Arab oil embargo, but this had subsided. Now oil rigs in the North Sea were quote-unquote producing. New life was being pumped into the British economy by the oil being pumped ashore in Scotland. Norway, too, was extracting North Sea petroleum and was rising in affluence among the top-ranking nations. So non-exuberant attitudes were, again, temporarily plausible. In America, shortages of gasoline and fuel oil had, for a while, been hard not to notice, though even in 1974, they had been relatively mild. In 1977 and 78, Americans underwent harsh winters but surmounted some newsworthy economic dislocations and some discomfort. In 1978, these problems were aggravated by a coal miner strike, and in 1979, the upheaval in Iran resulted in renewed gasoline shortages. But fossil acreage deprivations were, for a while, nuisances that came and went. People soon adjusted to paying higher prices for fuel after OPEC decreed that they must. When above-ground stockpiles of mined coal were drawn down during the 1978 strike, the United Mine Workers and the coal mine operators, quote-unquote, were jawboned into arriving at a strike settlement, though there was no official or public recognition of the fact that this merely returned them to drawing down exhaustible underground stocks of unmined coal. And if the Europeans thought the North Sea provided the kind of anti-crash insurance they sought, Americans took the same view of Alaska's North Slope. Not visible to the average citizen in the colossal energy-consuming countries was the fact that for several years the ratio of proven oil reserves to ongoing consumption had been falling. Not realized by those who now felt reassured that easily usable energy was going to continue to be plentiful was the fact that several deposits comparable in magnitude to the North Sea and Alaskan North Slope oil fields would need to be discovered each year to feed fuel appetites already so colossal and obstinately growing. Instead, what was visible was the fact that the once controversial pipeline to Valdez was completed. Oil began flowing through it in July 1977. A few attempts to sabotage it either fizzled or only briefly impeded the flow and gave Americans the somehow comforting illusion that voracious energy appetites could always be fed as long as adequate quote-unquote security measures were taken to protect our hunter-gatherer facilities. Tankers brought the oil from Valdez to California in sufficient abundance to exceed the capacity of coastal refineries and continental pipelines. The resulting glut, quote-unquote, was more fanned by the flames of cornucopianism. Once more fanned by the flames of cornucopianism, giving the myth of limitlessness new plausibility in a time when it ought to have been nearing extinction. Opportunity becomes necessity. In the past, when the myth of limitlessness was more excusably plausible, technological progress ran ahead of population growth and ahead of resource appetite enlargement. This gave us room to grow. When we entered post-exuberant times, we faced a reversal of this situation. Growth was continuing and had become a hard-to-break habit, an ingrained expectation now threatening to run ahead of technological advances. Growth momentum was now demanding that the technicians make their breakthroughs as needed to keep us from feeling the pinch of the world's limits. What had been a land of limitless opportunity, quote-unquote, became a land obsessed with conjuring enough new opportunities to keep pace with compulsive growth. It was not the first time in human history that opportunities had developed into precarious requirements. It is instructive to look at the case of the Irish. There were only about 2 million human inhabitants on the Emerald Isle in 1700, a century after the potato was introduced. At first, potatoes were an addition to the roster of Ireland's food crops. In time, they were to become the mainstay of the Irish sustenance base. For reasons I shall not delve into here, having to do with the already troubled history of that country. Eventually, they came to be virtually the entire fare of perhaps as many as 90% of the people. In 1727, before this had come about, oat crops failed, so the people of Ireland ate up their potatoes about 2 months sooner than they usually would have done, and many starved before winter had ended. This experience was the provocation for Jonathan Swift's satirical essay called A Modest Proposal, depicting a solution to the problems of Ireland by eating superabundant children. In 1739, Ireland was subjected to an unusual November freezing spell, which destroyed potatoes still in the field and already in storage. It had been estimated that 300,000 people died. But thenceforth, as the Irish became more and more committed to reliance on the potato, their numbers expanded, for a while at an accelerating pace, until they had passed the 8 million people mark by the census of 1841. In the top panel of Figure 2, I have plotted the Irish population curve fitted to dots representing actual data. Population was still rising, probably through a kind of demographic momentum, when a fungus infection of potato plants reached Ireland in 1845. It turned potatoes into stinking, inedible, gooey globs. As the fungus organism, a competitor of Homo sapiens, took over the consumption of potatoes, the fungus eruption terminated the prior human eruption. A people who had become so completely dependent on one type of resource, which now turned out to be a fallible resource, were living so precariously that a population crash was inevitable when that resource did indeed fail. Recent census have thus shown Ireland, both the Republic and Northern Ireland together, to be inhabited by only about half as many people as lived there just prior to the famine. One striking feature of the Irish experience is the fact that population was still increasing, and the rate of increase had barely begun to diminish when the crash began. The onset of crash was not heralded by any prior period of equilibrium, quote-unquote. For about four generations, the potato had been an opportunity for the Irish, but it soon became a requirement. For modern prosthetic hunter-gatherer nations, fossil acreage has been similarly converted by exuberant growth of both population and industry, from an abundance of opportunities into an indispensable requirement. Although in the Irish case, we know what happened to population, it crashed, but this crash consisted partly of emigration rather than a total die-off, we can only surmise the carrying capacity trend. It does seem certain that the 8,175,124 population figure for 1841 had exceeded what the sustainable carrying capacity of the land might have been even if potatoes had not been susceptible to blight. Sooner or later, soil deterioration from excessive use would have taken a similar toll, though more gradually. The lower panel of Figure 2 shows the remarkable periodic population cycles of appallingly large amplitude that are possible in the predator-prey pair of species, like the people of Ireland and the potatoes on which they subsisted. The lynx happens to be predisposed to subsist almost exclusively on the snowshoe rabbit, the varying hare. Its prey species is capable of rapid multiplication and can thus recover dramatically after its own population crashes. Consumption of rabbits by lynxes appears to be, at most, only part of the reason for rabbit crashes. Many of the hares die from a syndrome called shock disease, characterized by liver degeneration and thermal hypoglycemia. The incidence of shock disease appears to depend upon population density, population pressure. Compare the Sika deer on James Island mentioned in Chapter 13. However the malady comes about, as the hare population crashes, the lynx are left without adequate sustenance, and they crash too. Their too complete reliance on rabbits is equivalent to the excessive Irish commitment to the potato, and about every 10 years, the lynxes have undergone the Irish-type experience of relentless increase being abruptly superseded by precipitous decline. Minds that think ecologically can penetrate beyond the idiosyncrasies of political history, such as the prolongation of feudal warfare in Ireland and the chronic conflict between the Irish and the English, or between Protestants and Catholics. They can see from the lynx cycles or the Irish population experience the utter folly inherent in the American Petroleum Institute slogan, quote, "A country that runs on oil can't afford to run short," unquote. The slogan becomes much truer if we delete its last two words. A country that runs on oil can't afford to. The slogan becomes much truer when we delete the two words. For any species, human, feline, or whatever, excessive dependence upon a non-constant resource base makes life precarious. Many former settlements in the American West surged into brief prosperity and then atrophied into ghost towns. Essentially, the same process was at work there and in Ireland. People allowed themselves to become numerous and extremely dependent upon a single type of resource that could not remain always abundantly available. Among the ghost towns, of course, crash presumably consisted entirely of out-migration. As long as there were other niches in the national economy into which ex-boomtown folk could move, actual die-off was quite unnecessary. Half or more of the Irish crash consisted of emigration. For a world population that has overshot carrying capacity, however, emigration is not a feasible alternative to die-off. Pasts and their futures. Even in the face of precedents like Ireland, eminent minds have continued to disregard the prospect of crash for prosthetic societies. Herman Kahn and his associates, for example, assumed that a logistic curve was still the appropriate model to represent the American experience with growth. Moreover, they quite arbitrarily assumed that America had merely arrived at the curve's inflection point by the time of the national bicentennial. See Figure 3, Panel A. That assumption allowed them to project a further 200 years of growth for this nation, albeit progressively decelerating growth. The scale of American life would eventually be twice as high as had already been reached if actual population increased leveled off much sooner than 200 years hence. And much of the increased scale could take the form of further enlargement of per capita consumption. In any event, there was, they supposed, room for us to become both more numerous and more colossal. The logistic model hardly applies to all populations. It assumes a constant carrying capacity. It could have applied to Americans if, after European colonization of the North American continent began, the technology used by these new inhabitants had not continued to advance. Then the merely geographic increment of carrying capacity would have produced an expansion of population to fill the newly available but fixed number of niches. At first, the expansion would have shown an accelerating pattern. The age of exuberance was a manifestation of that pattern, a response to the exploited niches then available in the New World. Eventually, the pattern would have changed to decelerating growth as the ceiling was approached. Technology did not remain static, however. Recognizing that the technological change that has turned Homo sapiens into Homo colossus enables us to consume exhaustible resources at escalating per capita rates and enables us to take over for ecologically unproductive uses lands that might otherwise have provided sustenance in the form of renewable resources. Panel B of Figure 3 shows carrying capacity being reduced as population expanded in the age of exuberance. The future portion of Panel B depicts what supposedly might happen if, as is advocated by those who have become just enough ecologically aware to sound the alarm, the nation or the world succeeds in halting growth very soon. So sharp a turn in the trend curve from still accelerating progress, quote-unquote, to a steady state almost overnight, would inevitably be one of the most socially traumatic experiences in American history. Accordingly, those persons who oppose the steady state society idea insist that such a transition would be intolerable. Many of them also insist that it is not necessary. But even the advocates of such a revolutionary curbing of aspirations tend to assume that the line between past and future occurs at a point in time when growth has not yet overshot carrying capacity. If overshoot has already occurred, or must occur, because of demographic and technological momentum already generated, then the model depicted in panel B is already obsolete, whether or not such a transition to equilibrium might have once been feasible. Resistance to abrupt change of deeply ingrained habits, expectations, and institutional forms and processes probably means the curve could not be voluntarily or democratically bent toward the horizontal as sharply as shown in panel B anyway. Sociocultural and economic momentum would tend to make panel C more realistic. That is, the growth curve will continue upward even as more and more people begin to sense something like a decline in carrying capacity. Overshoot will occur if it hasn't already. We may come to feel guilty about stealing from the future, but we will continue to do it. Overshoot will further aggravate the reduction of carrying capacity. Crash must follow. The greater the overshoot, the greater the crash. After human population has crashed, resource species populations could again grow faster than they would have consumed. Thus, in panel C, the carrying capacity curve is shown bottoming out and starting to recover as a result of human population crash. Another cycle of human increase follows. This lynx-like recovery would be possible if carrying capacity were entirely or even mainly determined by renewable resources, i.e. if Homo sapiens were still a consumer of organic products entirely derived from other rabbit-like living components of the biotic community. This is manifestly not the case. Hence, in panel D, carrying capacity has been represented by two different curves. A major fraction of the recent apparently high carrying capacity for human high-energy living must be attributed to temporary resources. In other words, non-renewable fossil acreage, the Earth's savings deposits. In panel D, it is optimistically assumed that the component of carrying capacity based on renewable resources has remained stable so far, but it is recognized that serious overshoot induced by temporarily high composite carrying capacity will at least temporarily undermine even the sustainable component. Energy plantations, for example, one of the cargoist proposals, will tend to aggravate the competitive relation between our fuel-burning prosthetic machinery and ourselves. Land taken over to feed technology will not feed humans. So temporary carrying capacity is shown actually dipping below the horizontal line for a while, before it recovers and becomes again simply carrying capacity. The lesson from panel D is that crash caused by the exhaustion of phantom carrying capacity by Homo colossus could preclude a later cycle of regrowth. The boundary between past and future is drawn in panel D, as in the other three panels, at a time when population appears not yet to have overshot carrying capacity. Whether or not that optimistic feature of the model is justified by current facts makes little difference. If current practices have committed us to a trajectory that continues upward so that it is destined soon to cross the descending curve that represents global carrying capacity, a capacity not yet acknowledged to be finite. My own view, of course, is that the curves have already crossed. And he wrote that in 1980. Either way, the past shown in panel D more nearly accords with ecological history than do the past shown in panels A, B, or C. The future hypothesized by Herman Kahn's think tank group is dangerously optimistic because it is based on the least realistic past. But the past shown in panel B and C are also less realistic than the past shown in panel D. The futures shown in panel B and C are therefore also probably somewhat optimistic, although it seems necessary to enclose that word in quotation marks, because even if panel B's future seems dismal, and the panel C future seems disastrous. Yes. Because, yeah, even panel C seems dismal, C is disastrous. Light from Alaska. The fungus organism that was destroying Ireland's potatoes must have seemed, from 1845 on, to be the cause of human woe in the land. It would not have been obvious to a more ultimate cause that a more ultimate cause was the fateful deepening of human dependence on a vulnerable resource and the imprudent human increase induced by that resource's necessarily temporary abundance. Similarly, as Homo Colossus hurtles onward into a future whose central feature has to be a deepening deficit in caring capacity, the temptation persists to attribute human hardship to such forces as inflation, that somehow devours, quote-unquote, prosperity. Without an ecological paradigm to remove cornucopian cataracts, people remain blind to resource depletion and see only the rising monetary costs resulting from pursuit of ever less accessible supplies as obstacles to the good life. Without an ecological paradigm to remove cornucopian cataracts, people remain blind to resource depletion and see only the rising monetary costs resulting from pursuit of ever less accessible supplies as the obstacles to the good life. Inexorably escalating prices, rather than physical scarcity, are perceived as the obstacle to continuing lavish consumption and as the source of inequitable distribution. From past habits of thought, tycoons or tyrants are blamed. But think about Alaska for a moment. It is now a supplier of oil that is imagined to be a kind of insurance against crash. The oil industry spent roughly 1,000 times as many dollars to build the pipeline from the North Slope to Valdez as the United States government had paid to purchase Alaska. Even allowing for a century of shrinkage of the dollar, the pipeline cost is almost 100 times as large a fraction of the modern annual GNP as the fraction of 1867 GNP spent for Alaska. Many Americans in 1867 had considered exorbitant their government's expenditure of about 2 cents per acre to acquire, quote, an Arctic wasteland, unquote. Later, possession of the vast Alaskan wilderness, a final geographic frontier, probably prolonged for some Americans the psychological blessing of the age of exuberance.
Did for me.
Did for Connie Barlow. For a few thousand persons each year who migrated northward in recent decades to escape pressures of the colossal way of life that had become standard in the lower 48 states, Seward's Folly, as it was called, remained until the 1970s a haven. Then, with oil development, there came big money, a deluge of prosthetic apparatus, and opportunists both corporate and individual. The great land, quote-unquote, lost much of its haven quality. Secretary Seward had not quite matched President Jefferson's achievement in territorial expansion, but no doubt we did acquire something valuable in purchasing this northern land. Its greatest value, however, may turn out not to be either the homesteadable land or the oil or other extractable material resources, but the ecological lessons available from research conducted in some of its extreme environments. If we have to be deeply concerned at last about living in a condition of overshoot, we need certain knowledge obtainable from Alaska's North Slope more than we need its petroleum. Knowledge no one realized would become so humanly salient has been accumulating since the Office of Naval Research began supporting investigation of Arctic ecology through an Arctic research laboratory in Barrow. On Alaska's northernmost tip. There, the cyclical blooming and crashing of lemming populations has been one of the phenomena under systematic scrutiny. See top panel in figure 4. The lemmings live and die according to the kind of pattern shown in panel C of figure 3. Research lets us see why. Lemmings almost disappear every 3 or 4 years after becoming remarkably abundant in between. In their Arctic habitat, biotic communities have much simpler composition, far less species diversity, than in more temperate latitudes. Arctic vegetation tends to consist of dwarf shrubs, grasses, sedges, mosses, lichens, and herbs. All these plants grow very close to the ground. The simplicity of biotic communities in Arctic regions result in periodic population fluctuations that are more easily seen than the less violent and less conspicuously regular cycles occurring in more complex ecosystems. At Barrow, in seasons when the brown lemmings, Lemminus trimucrontatus, are abundant, very little vegetation escapes their chopping incisors. Inland, the growing season may be about 10 weeks long, but on the coastal plain, it is both shorter and more variable, averaging perhaps 7 or 8 weeks. Lemmings eat all year beneath the snow cover in winter, consuming accumulated vegetable matter that grew in less than one-fifth of a year. It is little wonder that their population dynamics resemble the detritivore pattern. Lemmings reproduce several generations per year. In habitats where only one single species of lemming is common, a fluctuation that is striking in both amplitude and periodicity results. In peak years, the lemmings may be 500 times as numerous as in the year following a crash and preceding renewal eruption. It is worth recalling that Homo sapiens is now 500 times as numerous as just before agriculture began, and less of the world now escapes the hungry jaws of our technology. Where there are two species of small herbivores, population cycles vary. Both the intervals between recognizable periods of abundance and the amplitude of differences between highs and lows may fluctuate. Where there are more than two species present, the respective populations will be in competitive interaction, being differentially susceptible to environmental influences, to predation, etc. The pattern of oscillation for any one population is unlikely to coincide precisely with that of a coexisting species. This affords some stability to the biotic community. In the Brook Range foothills, five microtene species are found, with overlapping habitat distributions. There are similarities in their feeding and sheltering activities. Competition among them may depress their respective populations, functioning as an antidote to overshoot, and reduce the likelihood of strong fluctuations. Moving northward toward the coast, the boom and bust population cycle in small mammals such as the lemming becomes most clearly evident on the Arctic coastal plain and in the lowland areas of regionally extensive marshes. These are areas where the species diversity of the biotic community becomes most simplified. Why are the findings of ecological inquiry in the Arctic so valuable to mankind? Because only in regions far beyond the temperate zones do there occur natural ecosystems so simplified by nature's own forces that they provide a clear preview of the destiny toward which mankind is rushing. We rush toward a destiny we have not paused to discern because, under the influence of the cornucopian paradigm, we readily mistake accelerated drawdown, which shortens our future, for a solution to our predicament. Let me read that paragraph again. It's the last paragraph in this section. Why are the findings of ecological inquiry into the Arctic so valuable to mankind? Because only in regions far beyond the temperate zones do there occur natural ecosystems so simplified by nature's own forces that they provide a clear preview of the destiny toward which mankind is rushing. We rush toward a destiny we have not paused to discern because, under the influence of the cornucopian paradigm, we readily mistake accelerated drawdown, which shortens our future, for a solution to our predicament. Back to the takeover method? However, it is time to begin seeing that renewed reliance on the older takeover method of enhancing human carrying capacity could be disastrous too, for a species so numerous and all-consuming as humans have become. With much of the biosphere not yet under human management, though none of it totally escapes human influence anymore, people readily assume that all talk of limits to growth is unnecessary defeatism. Some of the technological powers we have derived from reliance on the drawdown method now enable us to practice the takeover method more effectively than ever. Thus, even if drawdown must eventually fail us, it has armed us to engage again in the older and supposedly quite benign method. Proposals for clearing jungles and turning them into farms and pastures, making the land support humans instead of jungle creatures, are proposals for renewal of takeover. Proposals for reclaiming deserts by irrigation, making the land support humans instead of the creatures adapted by evolution to arid environments, are likewise proposals for further takeover. We know, however, that former forest and jungle land, especially in the tropics, often turns out to fail as farmland due to unwanted changes in soil and climate that follow the loss of tree cover. We know, too, that irrigation leads in time to changes in soil salinity that have to be resisted by means that didn't used to be feasible until modern drawdown-based technology was available. Not all cornucopian takeover proposals envisage taking over land. Homo colossus even proposes to take over enlarged fractions of the sunshine upon which the life of this planet depends. To cargoists, solutions of energy shortage problems seem feasible partly because there is so much unexploited, quote-unquote, sunlight falling on every square meter of the Earth's surface. Cargoist minds suppose that all we need to do is take over for human use by various devices solar energy that is now going to waste, quote-unquote. Proposals of this sort have been offered both by proponents of perpetual economic expansion and by opponents of other more conventional but objectionable energy schemes, such as coal, quote-unquote, development or nuclear power plant construction. Almost never is consideration given to the possibility that taking over some additional fraction of the solar flux that now drives the world's climate might produce ecosystem changes detrimental to human interests. All that quote-unquote unused sunlight is assumed to be available. And then he has in parentheses, I personally favor widespread small-scale domestic application of solar energy technology, especially in preference to most other means of new energy conversion that have been proposed. Nevertheless, I consider it ironic that solar energy enthusiasts can criticize advocates of coal and fission for disregarding ecological costs and calculating only monetary costs, while they themselves glibly regard solar energy as free, just because we can't be billed for the incoming sunshine. Nature will have the last word, and solar enthusiasts have not shown any caution about what it might turn out to be. The trouble with even the takeover method, now that we are so numerous and have already undergone a revolution of rising aspirations, is that it is like moving down from the Brooks Range foothills and putting ourselves under the cycle-causing forces characteristic of the Arctic coastal plains' simplified ecosystem. The more of the Earth's resources we take over for human use, even the renewable ones, the more nearly we reduce the global ecosystem to one that approximates the simplistic polarity of the one in which the lemmings live, and in which they crash. All vegetation serves as sustenance for them, so they are quote-unquote free to erupt and die off without the damping effect of competitors. As we saw in Chapter 7, mankind's farms are contrived ecosystems in which tides of natural succession have been turned back. Methodological elimination of all competitors, weeds and pests, and insistence that a given tract of land shall produce a one-species crop amounts to artificial imposition of a man-and-crops ecosystem type that is perilously simplified as the lemming and tundra type on the Alaskan North Coast. Efforts to bring still larger percentages of the world's quote-unquote arable land under human cultivation may seem like a solution to problems of scarcity, but with ecological eyes, we can see that they are an invitation to enhance probability of disaster. Already, we have come a long way toward making the world as ecologically simple as the northern Alaskan tundra since our ancestors first began sowing and harvesting crops. If we revert to takeover as a supposed means of sustaining exponential economic growth, we would not have far to go on any timescale. The dangers of ecosystem simplification by further takeover are indicated by the lower panel of Figure 4, representing a laboratory experiment. There, the simplest conceivable ecosystem was contrived, two species in a nutrient solution, one species feeding on the other. Carrying capacity for the predator species was synonymous with the abundance of one other species present, its prey. Functionally, this contrived system simulated the simplicity of the tundra community with the lemmings, or the simplicity of the ecosystem comprising the Irish and their potatoes. If mankind could succeed in eliminating all competitors and making all coexisting species with which we share our world serve as our prey, we would have a world ecosystem essentially similar to the simple but contrived one in the lab. If we persisted in denying the possibility of overshoot, would we not, as unwittingly as the paramecium, overconsume our prey, thereby reducing the Earth's carrying capacity for us, so that we would necessarily crash, allowing the prey species then to recover, allowing our descendants to erupt again, and so on? In effect, the more we might succeed with the takeover method, the more we would thereby be fated to overuse, i.e. drawdown, existing populations of renewable resource species. Our success by the drawdown method using exhaustible resources has brought us to a situation where some people can seriously contemplate proposals that lead toward almost total takeover. It has become imperative for us to recognize that quote-unquote success in such further takeover methods would require us, like the paramecium, consuming on faster than sustained yield basis the yeast, to revert to drawdown. It was enough of a misstep to have committed ourselves to drawing down non-living resources. It would be a double folly if we were to become any more committed to consuming renewable resources faster than their rate of renewal. Homo colossus is already drawing down even the standard crop of timber and other biomass. This is indicated by recent studies showing that the CO2 content of the world's atmosphere has been increasing over the past century faster than can be accounted for by combustion of fossil fuels. If biomass consumption already exceeds replacement when fossil fuels are still available, what must mankind be expected to do when the global ecosystem as the Carboniferous legacy runs out? A third way, modesty. Whichever of the two historic approaches we take, either choosing to accelerate drawdown or indulging in additional takeover, our new ecological paradigm enables us to see that eventually we end up shifting back to the other. Either traditional way, if prolonged, leads to an inhuman future, not toward the lasting solution of temporary vexing problems, as cargoists suppose. For any lasting solution, we must abandon both of these ultimately disastrous methods. Drawdown bails us out of present difficulties by shortening our future. Takeover was of lasting value earlier in human history, but that time is past. We must learn to live within carrying capacity without trying to enlarge it. We must rely on renewable resources consumed no faster than at sustained yield rates. The last best hope for mankind is ecological modesty. Let me reread that paragraph. We must learn to live within carrying capacity without trying to enlarge it. We must rely on renewable resources consumed no faster than at sustained yield rates. The last best hope for mankind is ecological modesty, otherwise known as humility before the Lord.
Yes.
Red herring or Rubicon? Renewal of the takeover method may nevertheless tempt each nation. Some hard ecological thinking will be required to recognize it when it happens and to discern the ultimate implications. For example, the Tennessee Valley Authority wanted to use a stretch of the Little Tennessee River as a reservoir. Evolution, however, had produced there a small perch species that lived nowhere else. Apparently restive to transplanting, the snail darter was threatened with extinction by construction of a $116 million dam that would alter its sole habitat beyond its tolerance. Thus, mankind and this little fish species became competitors. Each had a use for the place that was incompatible with the other's use of it. Earlier, when Congress had enacted a law requiring human beings and their organized agencies to abstain from extinguishing other species by altering their habitat more than they could tolerate, this seemed like a good idea. But by the time the Tellico Dam was ready to be put into operation, the federal administration was obliged to deem it silly that a mere fish could preclude any return on the huge monetary investment. So the Attorney General argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, with a vial in his hand containing a 3-inch specimen of the fish, that this insignificant competitor should not be permitted to cause so much trouble. In June 1978, however, the court declared 6-3 that it must have been the plain intent of Congress when it passed the Endangered Species Act to, quote, halt and reverse the trend towards species extinction, whatever the cost, unquote. The court's decision prompted congressional action to remove the act's protection of the particular endangered species that was standing in the way of this piece of technological progress. The way the press portrayed the case was as much like the Attorney General's presentation. The reading public was thus probably inclined to accept the idea that for a 3-inch fish to take precedence over a $116 million human investment was ridiculous. Here was an instance where the ecological issue was vastly different from the economic issue and was far from adequately reflected in even the legal issue. What if an ecologically enlightened Congress had meant to impose a limit on human indulgence in the takeover method because, carried too far, takeover can lead to humanity itself, not just the tiny fish, into the valley of the shadow of death? And what if the Chief Justice, who wrote the majority opinion, had been ecologically sophisticated enough to declare that the plain intent of Congress had been just that, to protect the human species by curbing human dominance? To protect the human species by curbing human dominance. Wow. The issue that the Attorney General argued was simply whether the snail darter's preservation was worth writing off that $116 million, about 53 cents per American citizen. But the issue that was more important to the human species was whether the time had come to command the forces of takeover to halt and advance no further. Wherever the forces of ecological enlightenment might have tried to draw the line, the particular endangered species could probably be made by legal and economic minds to seem absurdly insignificant in comparison with human needs. Dolphins, for example, are much more than 3 inches long, and they are intelligent mammals. This did not stop the tuna industry from objecting vehemently to marine mammal protective policies that would significantly raise the cost of netting tuna. In light of Figure 4, it should be evident that the question of the significance or insignificance of a particular competitor standing in the way of human expansion may mask the real danger to mankind's future. Okay. Say that again.
What occurred to me listening to those last few paragraphs is that the deep ecologists who put forth the intrinsic value 20 years ago or so as being more foundational than the shallow ecologists, which
shallow environmentalists,
were all about protecting national parks so that we can have our recreation or our spiritual there and whatever. And the deep ecologists said, this is beyond human needs. This is the intrinsic value of species. And it stops there. This thing where he's putting the broader ecological paradigm that the courts did not do for the snail darter, but which could have been done, is that this gives us a absolute barrier to, we will not keep going with the takeover method because our own species
exactly.
will go extinct.
Our very survival depends
our
on
very, it. And so it becomes a leapfrog over deep ecology
right.
for that very reason. And it kind of compounds with, I was looking at Nelson Stover has tonight he's got some Skype webinar thing that's Nature as Divine, where he's going to be reading some quotes of Thomas Berry and then he gives some talks. And to me, that's so gentle compared to the way that I see overshoot now. And it's that same thing of the deep ecology, which used to be my deepest thing, you know, my 1997 book, Green Space, Green Way of Science, Deep Ecology, the intrinsic value was sort of the foundation where everything stopped. And now I see it's leapfrogged over. A deeper ecological awareness puts us back into the realm of practical humanity, humanity's future, that nobody has to have any intrinsic value commitment to creatures for. This is 100% applicable to everybody on this planet who isn't a biblical literalist thinking Jesus is coming down in the next decade anyway, so who cares?
Right, exactly. And what adds an even more interesting, different, but complementary focus is the theological language that I'll be using to speak about not just that nature is divine.
Yeah, it's too
general. Wrath of God is communicated through climate change.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the kind of thing.
Absolutely. Reality is Lord. Your Santa Claus thing that you just wrote down.
Right.
We've had a childish view of God. You just had this Rebbe this morning.
Yep.
We've been thinking of God like Santa Claus, benign, bringing all these gifts.
Here's what I wrote this morning. We're in trouble. We're in the trouble that we are now because we've had an entirely childish and imaginary view of God. We mistakenly thought God was only in the blessings, like a heavenly Santa Claus. We didn't know, and we're only now painfully discovering, that God is in the limits. That's an adult perspective. In fact, it may be the single most important adult perspective about God.
God is in the limits.
Yep. All right, we got our best bet. Expect the worst. Mankind is condemned to bet on an uncertain future. The stakes have become phenomenally high. Affluence, equity, democracy, humane tolerance, peaceful coexistence between nations, races, sects, sex, parties, all are in jeopardy. Ironically, the less hopeful we assume human prospects to be, the more likely we are to act in ways that will minimize the hardships ahead for our species. Ironically, the less hopeful we assume human prospects to be, the more likely we are to act in ways that will minimize the hardships ahead for our species.
That's key.
It really is key. Ecological understanding of the human predicament indicates that we live in times when the American habit of responding to a problem by asking, "All right, now what do we do about it?" must be replaced by a different query that does not assume all problems are soluble. What must we avoid doing to keep from making a bad situation necessarily worse? Wow. Ecological understanding of the human predicament indicates that we live in times when the American habit of responding to a problem by asking, "All right, now what do we do about it?" must be replaced by a different query that does not assume all problems are soluble. What must we avoid doing to keep from making a bad situation unnecessarily worse? Refer again to figure 3. The most hopeful hypothetical prospect is the one shown in panel A, but betting on that model means going ahead with exuberant drawdown, business more or less as usual. That is probably the worst thing that we can do. The bet will have the effect of falsifying the model ever more drastically by further hastening the reduction of actual carrying capacity shown in the other three models, but not recognized in this one. If we bet instead on panel B, supposing that there is yet time to effect a swift leveling off before we overshoot the already declining carrying capacity, we may cut our losses in comparison with betting on panel A. Still, we allow ourselves to assume that resumption of takeover in place of drawdown is a safe strategy. By thus letting the snail darter and other inconveniently endangered species become extinct, we move on toward a situation more like panel C than panel B. However, if we choose instead to bet on panel C, we would be making no distinction between renewable and non-renewable resources, between temporary and permanent carrying capacity. So we would not be taking steps to protect the latter from destruction by technological powers unleashed by the former. This would push us into the situation depicted in panel D, presumably the worst case. If we bet on panel D in the first place, the adaptive steps called for include stringent efforts to protect renewable carrying capacity from both instability arising from excessive, any further, takeover, and from panic drawdown of already diminishing phantom carrying capacity. Specifically, we would insist on strict enforcement of ecosystem preservation policies prescribed by the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and many other pieces of protective legislation dating back to the Antiquities Act of 1906 and beyond. We would do this for the ultimate sake of our own species. We would also do our best to stretch out remaining supplies of fossil acreage instead of competing to hasten their consumption. We would painstakingly revise our cultural values to reduce resource appetites. We would foster non-consumptive modes of human enjoyment, and we would learn to reckon our wealth in terms of our environmental assets rather than in terms of the rate at which we plunder them.
Wow.
I'm going to read that whole thing again. If we bet on panel D in the first place, the adaptive steps called for include stringent efforts to A, protect renewable carrying capacity from both instability arising from excessive any further takeover and from panic drawdown of already diminishing phantom carrying capacity. Specifically, we would insist on strict enforcement of ecosystem preservation policies prescribed in the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and many other pieces of protective legislation dating back to the Antiquities Act of 1906 and beyond. And we would do this for the ultimate sake of our own species, as you were just talking about before, Connie Barlow. B, we would also do our best to stretch out remaining supplies of fossil acreage instead of competing to hasten their consumption. C, we would painstakingly revise our cultural values to reduce resource appetites. D, we would foster non-consumptive modes of human enjoyment. And E, we would learn to reckon our wealth in terms of our environmental assets rather than in terms of the rate by which we plunder them. In sum, we would commit ourselves to becoming less colossal with all deliberate speed. Once we had set that course for ourselves, we would find ourselves committed to more extensive social and cultural change than has ever been achieved, or perhaps even really sought by past revolutionary movements. Editor's note, that's why religion is needed.
Yes.
In the final analysis, our best chance of achieving anything like the Panel B future depends on our taking Panel D seriously. Human self-restraint, practiced both individually and especially collectively, is our indispensable hope. It's what Aldo Leopold advocated. It is the essential idea contained in much conservationist legislation. It is the idea that commended itself in an inspired moment to a small band of explorers in the American West in 1870. The men who decided to restrain their own avarice and worked for an act of Congress to preserve intact the wonders of nature they had discovered in their exploration of the Yellowstone area had actually conceived in their campfire conversation the key to prolonging human life. They did not know this, nor did anyone else for a while. But 2 years of devoted effort did persuade the U.S. Congress to create the world's first national park from the lands this group had explored and discussed. With hindsight, we can see that the act of dedication inadequately heralded the significance of a new industrial form. Instead of acknowledging the revolutionary degree of self-restraint implicit in this new land use concept, the act merely proclaimed the northwest portion of Wyoming Territory to be, quote, a public park or pleasuring ground, unquote, and blandly gave its purpose as, quote, the benefit and enjoyment of the people, unquote. 100 years later, there were similar reserves in many lands dedicated by their respective governments as sanctuaries to which human reactive efforts upon local ecosystems were to be held to a minimum. And humans, as visitors rather than inhabitants, could be exposed to a heritage from which they could derive both pleasure and a special awareness of man's part in the biosphere. An alternative to succession was what the Yellowstone explorers had begun to invent in their campfire discussion. Knowing some of the ways of nature that were reviewed in Chapter 6, it can be seen that in the national park systems of many countries, more than under any other land use regime, Homo sapiens had begun consciously evolving the self-restraint that Aldo Leopold knew was mankind's only alternative to self-destruction. Decades before we began to realize it, there was an urgent need to begin generalizing to the whole habitat of man, to the whole earth, the concept embodied in that 1870 campfire decision. Not that human societies could, should, or ever would make the whole world into a public park or pleasure ground. However, we needed to protect ourselves from succession by somehow protecting our habitat from ourselves. We needed to protect ourselves from succession by somehow protecting our habitat from ourselves. After a century of experience with national parks, what the nations of the world and mankind at large were still doing to the 99%+ of the biosphere outside these enclaves required facing up to their most important lesson, namely that humanity may be best served by an environment we tried to avoid changing. Human self-restraint may serve human purposes better than human domination of the biosphere can. Human self-restraint may serve human purposes better than human domination of the biosphere can. Mankind derives benefits from ecosystems not dominated by man, benefits that may be unavailable from ecosystems man does dominate. Before the self-restraint embodied in the national park idea was quite one century old, a start was made toward generalizing it to the relation of mankind to the entire biosphere. An American manifestation of this belated and faltering start toward generalization was exemplified by congressional passage of the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, NEPA. Section 2 said that the purposes of the act were, quote, to declare a national policy which will encourage productive and enjoyable harmony between man and his environment, to promote efforts which will prevent or eliminate damage to the environment and biosphere and stimulate the health and welfare of man, to enrich the understanding of ecological systems and natural resources important to the nation, unquote. But even in the national parks, harmony between man and environment was proving to be an elusive goal. The volume of visitation became excessive, and people impaired by overuse the very specimens of wild nature they sought explicitly to preserve. American congressmen in 1969 were too new to ecological thinking to realize that what they were trying to do when they enacted the NEPA was to halt by legislative command the man-caused succession overtaking man. They certainly had little comprehension of succession's inexorability. NEPA required, among other things, that every recommendation for future legislation or other federal action, quote, significantly affecting the quality of the human environment, unquote, must include a detailed summary of the environmental impact of the proposed action, particularly its adverse environmental effects, alternatives to it, and the long-term resource commitments it would entail. Ostensibly, projects that would result in too much destructive environmental impact were to be abandoned after such an environmental impact statement, EIS, making this evident had been reviewed by higher authority. But this was only implicit, and before long, the filings of the EISs tended to become defined as a pro forma nuisance, after which habitat exploitation, as usual, was to remain the norm. But we had tried, and this needs to be remembered. 3 years later, on a wider scale, the world tried again to generalize the 1870 norm of self-restraint when the United Nations Conference on Human Environment met in Stockholm. It may be worth asking, what if the 41st Congress, instead of the 91st, had enacted NEPA in 1869 instead of 1969? What superhuman imagination would the 39 million post-Civil War Americans have needed to be able to decide then that their descendants a century later would be better served by their environment if they did not become 5 times more numerous and 20 times more urbanized? What inconceivable foresight would have been required for the members of the Virginia House of Burgesses, meeting in Williamsburg in 1769, to decide for their constituents' descendants over the next 2 centuries that the western lands then claimed by the English colony should be protected from eventual industrial exploitation? Could even a mind like Jefferson's have discerned the need to require an EIS to be filed by anyone who might invent strip mining as a means of obtaining massive quantities of coal from under those lands? Could anyone in the colonial capital have been expected to visualize 8 generations ahead of time when prevention might have been painless, the huge prosthetic machines used by the Central Ohio Coal Company for digging into the portions of Virginia's western claim that would long since have become the state of Ohio? What if Ferdinand and Isabella had been cautious and had required Christopher Columbus to submit an EIS before they authorized his proposed project of exploration? What would the earnest navigator have foreseen as the consequences likely to ensue from his voyage of discovery? I'm reminded of Thomas Berry's statement that when Henry Hudson's ship, the Half Moon, sailed up the Hudson River, every living being on this continent might have shuddered. Had he submitted an impact statement, could it possibly have described a forthcoming age of exuberance, the myths it would foster, and the democratic institutions it would nurture? Would the impact statement have predicted the eruption of Homo sapiens to fill up the carrying capacity surplus the voyage was going to disclose, or the cargoism, cosmeticism, cynicism, and ostracism by which post-exuberant men would strive to perpetuate obsolescent ways? Would the explorer's royal patrons have believed such wild ideas? Would they have sought ways to minimize the regrettable portions of the project's probable impact? No humans ever had that kind of imagination and foresight. We know with hindsight what our predecessors did not and could not foresee. By seeing with an ecological paradigm, we can recognize that filing essentially conjectural EISs and then trying somehow to walk softly, but in a still exploitive approach to the future, will not suffice. A much more basic change of direction is called for. We must become less detrivorous. We must maintain symbiosis with competitors to keeping from falling into the pattern of the lemmings in Alaska or the paramecia in the laboratory. Our best bet is to act as if we believe that we have already overshot, and to do our best to ensure that the inevitable crash consists as little as possible of outright die-off of Homo sapiens. Instead, it should consist as far as possible of the chosen abandonment of those seductive values characteristic of Homo colossus. Indeed, renunciation of such values may be the main alternative to renewed indulgence in cruel genocide. If crash should prove to be avoidable after all, a global strategy of trying to moderate expected crash is the strategy most likely to avert it. Let me read that paragraph again. Our best bet is to act as if we believe that we have already overshot and to do our best to ensure that the inevitable crash consists as little as possible of outright die-off of Homo sapiens. Instead, it should consist as far as possible of the chosen abandonment of those seductive values characteristic by Homo colossus. Indeed, renunciation of such values may be the main alternative to renewed indulgence in cruel genocide. If crash should prove to be avoidable after all, a global strategy of trying to moderate expected crash is the strategy most likely to avert it. History will record the period of global dominance by Homo colossus as a brief interlude. Our most urgent task is to develop policies designed not to prolong that dominance, but to ensure that the successor to Homo colossus will be, after all, Homo sapiens. Developing such policies must be so enormously difficult that it is not easy even to accept the urgency of the task. But the longer we delay beginning, the more numerous and colossal we become, thereby trapping ourselves all the more irredeemably in the fatal practice of stealing from our future. Here's the glossary to overshoot. In alphabetical order, of course. Abiotic substance, the non-living elements and components of the environment. Adaptation, modification of something to fit or go with something else. Hence, in ecology, the fitting of an organism to the requirements of its environment by means of adjustments of form or function. age of exuberance. The centuries of growth and progress that followed the sudden enlargement of habitat available to Europeans as a result of voyages of discovery. A period of expansion when a species takes exuberant advantage of the abundant opportunities in an eminently suitable but previously inaccessible habitat. Animal community. A biotic community in which animals play a conspicuous part of the collective adaptation of the total association of diverse organisms to their shared habitat. Enemy. Prevalence of the view that antisocial types of behavior are necessary as a means to attain socially prescribed goals. Antagonism, ecological. A relationship between two or more species or groups of organisms in which the activities or indirect effects of the activities of one are harmful to the other, may be quite impersonal, unintentional, and unconscious. Antagonism, emotional. Hostility, enmity, active opposition toward another individual or group may result from ecological antagonism. Antibiotic, adjective, opposite of symbiotic, tendency for the life processes and products of one organism to be harmful to another organism or type of organism. As a noun, chemically purified extra metabolite used in medicine to inhibit growth of a disease of disease-causing bacteria, for example, penicillin, refined from the extra metabolite exuded by the penicillin mold. Antinomian movements. Groups of people who seek to change social conditions they deplore by repudiating or violating social or legal codes which they assume have caused the deplored conditions. Autotrophs, producers. Organisms capable of photosynthesis, which convert abiotic substances into energy-rich organic substances. Also, technically, organisms capable of chemosynthesis, whereby they obtain energy to build up organic substances by oxidizing inorganic compounds. Not directly important to the argument of this book, so herein the word is used to denote only those organisms capable of photosynthesis. Biochemical cycles. Patterns of circulation and energy and a score of chemical elements involved in life processes, in systems comprising earth, water, air, and organisms. The chemical materials can be and are recycled over and over again. The energy cannot be recycled. Biomass. The amount of living material in a specified context. Biosphere. The region at and near the Earth's surface within which life occurs, including land, water, and air. All life on the entire planet. Biotic community. A more or less self-sufficient and localized web of life collectively adapting to the life support conditions of the local habitat. Biotic potential. The capacity for reproduction, or the number of offspring that theoretically could be produced by a parental pair. Bloom, see eruption. Eruption, the rapid exponential increase of a population after it suddenly gains access to an abundance of the resources it requires. Cargo cults. Systems of belief and ritual among Melanesian peoples in the islands of the Pacific, arising from their observation that the dominant European minority among them received vast quantities of material goods from unseen sources overseas. The native peoples, because of their sketchy and inaccurate notions of the origins of these goods, came to suppose they might be the rightful owners of such cargo and that it might ultimately be delivered to them. Cargoism. Faith that technological progress will stave off major institutional change, even in a post-exuberant world. The equivalent among people of industrial nations to the cargo cults of the Melanesian Islanders. Carnivore, an animal type that subsists by eating the flesh of other animals. Carrying capacity. The maximum population of a given species which a particular habitat can support indefinitely. Under specified technology and organization, in the case of the human species. carrying capacity deficit, the condition wherein the permanent ability of a given habitat to support a given form of life is less than the quantity of that form already in existence. Carrying capacity surplus. The condition wherein the permanent ability of a given habitat to support a given form of life exceeds the quantity of that form then in existence. Climax community. A self-perpetuating community comprising a combination of species that can successfully outcompete any alternative combination that might otherwise replace it on a given site. Colossus. Originally, the gigantic statue of Apollo at the entrance of the harbor of Rhodes, hence any gigantic person or thing. In this book, a human being equipped with tools or apparatus that greatly enlarge the resource demands and environmental impact of that organism. Competition. A relationship between two or more organisms in which each makes demands upon its environment similar to the demands made by the other, with the result that the presence of each hampers the other in some way. Cornucopian paradigm. A view of past and future human progress that disregards the carrying capacity concept pays no attention to the finiteness of the world or to differences between takeover and drawdown and accepts uncritically the myth of limitlessness. Cosmeticism. Faith that relatively superficial adjustments in our activities will keep the new world new and will perpetuate the age of exuberance. Crash. The more or less precipitate decline in numbers that follows when a population has exceeded the carrying capacity of its habitat, otherwise called a die-off. Cultural lag. Stress that occurs when interconnected patterns of culturally prescribed behavior or belief change at different rates of speed. Culture. A system of socially acquired and transmitted standards of judgment, belief, and conduct, as well as the social and material products of the resulting conventional activities. Culture of exuberance. The total complex of beliefs and practices associated with the opportunities for expansive life in the age of exuberance, a culture founded upon the myth of limitlessness. Cynicism. Ordinarily, a tendency to question the value of anything and everything. Hence, in this book, disbelief that the new world's newness made any difference or that its oldness has any significance. Disbelief that the age of exuberance was of any value or that its termination matters. Decomposers. Heterotrophic organisms, usually microscopic, that break down the complex organic compounds of dead plants and animals, thereby releasing simple substances that can be reused by autotrophic producer organisms. Detritivore, an organism that subsists by consuming detritus, by extension, any organism that uses the accumulated remains of long-dead organisms, including industrial human communities, which are detritivorous, insofar as they depend on massive consumption of the transformed organic remains of the Carboniferous period, known as fossil fuels. Detritus. Originally a geological term meaning fragments of rock or debris produced by disintegration and erosion, used by biologists to refer to the accumulated remains of organisms, for example, humus in the soil or decayed leaves in a pond, by extension, used in this book to refer to transformed remains of organisms that lived millions of years ago, such remains being useful as fossil fuels to organisms, humans, living today. Detritus ecosystem. An ecosystem in which detritivores play a major part. As organic detritus accumulates in a given habitat, there is a temporary increase in carrying capacity for detritus consumers. Insofar as these are capable of increasing much faster than the detritus accumulates, however, their introduction to the community after detritus has already accumulated, or their release from some constraint that had earlier held back their use of the accumulation, tends to result in a cycle of bloom and crash. They erupt, and then, as the detritus supply is exhausted, they die off. Deus ex machina. In ancient Greek drama, a deity brought in by stage machinery to intervene in the action, hence any artificial or improbable resolution of a dilemma. In this book, cargoism is regarded as an instance of this. Dichronic competition. A relationship between generations in which living organisms satisfy their wants at the expense of their descendants. Dominance. The capacity of a species to exert more influence than any other associated species in its community upon the characteristics of their habitat and upon other species in the community. Ecological inequalities that arise from different resource exploitation strategies characterizing different types of organisms. Dominant. Adjective. Having the capacity to exert more influence than any other species in the community. Noun. The particular species in a community with greater influence than the other. Drawdown method of extending caring capacity. An inherently temporary expedient by which life opportunities for a species are temporarily increased by extracting from the environment for use by that species some significant fraction of an accumulated resource that is not being replaced as fast as it is drawn down. See, by contrast, sustained yield. Ecological paradigm. In general, a view of the web of life that recognizes a common chemical basis for all types of organisms, including man, emphasizes the dependence of all life processes upon flows of energy and exchanges of chemical substance between organism and environment, and expects living forms inevitably to have effects upon each other by these exchanges. In this book, rejection of the notion of human exemption from ecological principles and affirmation of the view that ecological concepts are essential for understanding human experience. Ecology. The study of ecosystems, in other words, the study of interrelations in the web of life and between organisms and their environment. Ecosystem. A comprehensive web of interrelations between organisms, other organisms, and their environment. It tends to be characterized by the operation of various checks and balances. Enclose and control principle. Any adaptation wherein organisms retain homostatically within themselves conditions necessary to their life that have ceased to be reliably available externally. The principle by which, for example, organisms that were once confined to aquatic environments became adapted to life on dry land by maintaining within themselves a wet internal environment. Energy slaves. A metaphor by which the value of fossil energy is measured in terms of the human muscle power equivalent to it. For example, burning about 32 gallons, U.S. gallons, 121 liters of gasoline, releases energy equivalent to the energy content of the food an active adult human being would consume in a year. Thus, the work obtained from this gasoline tends to approximate the amount of work that might have been obtained in a year from a human slave, assuming comparable energy conversion efficiency by fuel-burning machinery and food-burning human bodies. Energy subsidy. Energy from sources other than sunlight applied to the growing of crops, for example, fossil energy in excess of the human labor displaced by its use, used in operating farm equipment, energy used to move water for artificial irrigation, the energy content of synthetic fertilizers applied to the soil, etc. Ethnocentrism. The tendency to regard the behavior of people raised by other standards than our own as wrong rather than just different. Evolution. Imperfect replication of the traits of organisms in their progeny and the selective retention among descendant populations of those traits best adapted to prevailing environmental circumstances. Extra metabolites. Substances given off by organisms which, as they accumulate in the environment, affect the life processes of other organisms and thus function as environmental chemical regulators. Exuberance. Ecological. The lavish use of resources by members of a freely expanding population who are, at a given time, significantly fewer in number than the maximum permitted by the carrying capacity of their habitat. exuberance, emotional. A joyous, optimistic, almost euphoric mood can result from ecological exuberance. Exhaustible resources. Usable resources that are not currently being recreated by natural processes at rates comparable to actual or potential rates of consumption. For example, detritus, food, fossil fuels, minerals, metallic ores. Fate. In human experience, a future that happens to us regardless of our own actions. As defined by the sociologist C. Wright Mills, the summary outcome not intended by anyone but resulting from innumerable small decisions about other matters by innumerable people. For example, no one intended that city air should become smoggy, but the cumulative effects of individual decisions to buy and drive automobiles, to burn fuels to heat homes, or to buy products of fuel-using industries have brought about this unintended environmental change. Fish acreage. The additional farmland a given nation would need in order to supply food equivalent to that portion of its sustenance obtained from the sea. Food chain. A hierarchy of relationships between species that consume or are consumed by other species. For example, grass eaten by cow, beef or dairy products eaten by humans, human blood consumed by mosquitoes, mosquitoes eaten by trout, etc. Fossil acreage. The equivalent farmland a given nation would need in order to supply organic fuel equivalent to the coal, petroleum, or natural gas produced products it now uses. Fossil fuels. Energy-rich substances created by geological transformation of the remains of organisms that lived long ago, including coal, petroleum, and natural gas. Generation. As a measure of time, the average interval between becoming a parent and becoming a grandparent, or between being born and becoming a parent, assumed herein to be about 25 years for Homo sapiens. Ghost acreage. The additional farmland a given nation would need in order to supply that net portion of the food or fuel it uses but does not obtain from contemporary growth of organisms within its borders. For example, from net imports of agricultural products, from oceanic fisheries, from fossil fuels. Green Revolution. A dramatic increase in agricultural productivity resulting from use of specialty bred crop plants capable of higher per acre yields than varieties previously in use. Herbivore. An animal type that subsists by eating plant tissues. Heterotroph. Consumer. An organism which cannot convert abiotic substances into organic matter but must use for its sustenance materials produced by other organisms. Homeostasis. The prevention of change in some variable by means of compensatory change in another aspect of the system when an outside influence would otherwise have produced change in that variable. The damping of oscillations in biological processes by regulatory mechanisms. Homo colossus. See colossus. Colossus. Originally the gigantic statue of Apollo at the entrance of the harbor of Rhodes, hence any gigantic person or thing. In this book, a human being equipped with tools or apparatus that greatly enlarge the resource demands and environmental impact of that organism. Homo sapiens. The species of mammal that includes both the reader and the author, and all other contemporary human beings. A language-using, tool-making, social species descended from earlier types of humans who were also members of the genus Homo, capable of evolving culturally as well as genetically. Human community. A biotic community in which human beings, by virtue of their capacity for occupational and social differentiation, play so many of the roles that it appears the community is almost under human control. Human ecology. Properly defined, the comprehensive study of ecosystems involving mankind. Now a thoroughly interdisciplinary field of inquiry among sociologists, human ecology was regarded as a branch of academic sociology. They tended for a while to narrow it to the study of little more than the spatial structure of cities, afterward broadening it again to a more general study of social organization. Human exemptionalism. The notion that human beings are so fundamentally unlike other living creatures that principles of ecology, and perhaps many of the principles of other branches of biology too, are inapplicable to us. Eruption. The rapid exponential increase of a population after it suddenly gains access to an abundance of the resources it requires. Kilocalorie. A unit of energy, the amount of heat required to raise the temperature of 1 kilogram of water 1 degree Celsius. Limiting factor. Any condition in an ecosystem that tends to restrict growth of a population of organisms, or the resource a given population needs that happens to be available in lowest per capita abundance. Metabolism. Physical and chemical processes occurring in living cells, organisms, and biotic communities, whereby compounds are either built up or broken down, and energy is either fixed or released. Includes both anabolism, the process by which food is turned into living tissue, and catabolism, the process by which tissue is turned into waste products. Mutualism, a strong and reciprocal interdependence between different but associated life forms. See symbiosis. Symbiosis, mutual dependence of populations of differentiated organisms. Myth of limitlessness. The belief, more implicit than explicit perhaps, that the world's resources are sufficient to supply any conceivable human population engaged in any conceivable way of life for any conceivable duration. Derivatively, the belief either that a given resource is inexhaustible or that substitutes can always be found. Neo-exuberant. Newly committed to the culture of exuberance, whether or not the carrying capacity surplus that gave rise to that culture still exists. Net production. The quantity of organic matter produced during a given time period by photosynthesis in a given organism or community, minus the quantity destroyed by respiration. The new reality. The situation prevailing in the world following transition from a carrying capacity surplus to a carrying capacity deficit. Niche. The role that an organism of a given kind plays in an ecosystem. In other words, the kind of nutrients it has to obtain from its environment, the kind of things it must do to its environment in the process of living, the kinds of relationships it must have with other organisms to go on living, etc. Niche diversification. Increase in the structural complexity of a biotic community through enlargement of the number of distinct ecological niches. A common result of population pressure in any given niche. Among humans, occupational diversification is a special case of this natural process. Ostracism. Obstinately persistent belief in the myth of limitlessness. The unrealistic supposition that nothing basic has changed. Refusal to face facts. Overpopulation. Population in excess of carrying capacity. Population so numerous in proportion to resources that standards of living are lower than they would be if population were less numerous. Overshoot. Verb. To increase in numbers so much that the habitat's carrying capacity is exceeded by the ecological load, which must in time decrease accordingly. Noun. The condition of having exceeded for the time being the permanent carrying capacity of the habitat. Paradigm. An underlying shared idea of the fundamental nature of whatever it is that a collectivity of minds seeks to understand. An idea that guides inquiry and thought by defining what seems real, how things are presumed to work, and how additional facts about this reality and these processes may presumably be obtained. Phantom carrying capacity. Illusory or extremely precarious capacity of an environment to support a life form or a way of life. That portion of a population that cannot be permanently supported when temporarily available resources become unavailable. Photosynthesis. Creation of organic molecules from abiotic substances by the action of solar energy. a process that occurs in green plants, for example, by means of the catalytic action of a green substance called chlorophyll. Pioneer community. The type of association of organisms that is capable of using a site early in its developmental history, the earliest pre-climax community of a given on a given site. Plant community. A biotic community in which the dominant species are plants. Pollution. The accumulation of harmful substances produced by human activity in the environment in which humans live. By extension, the accumulation of any life-limiting extra metabolites in the environment of any species. Population density. Ratio of number of organisms of a given species to the number of units of space in which they live. For example, people per square mile. Population pressure. The frequency of mutual interference per capita per day resulting from the presence of others in a finite habitat. Post-exuberant. The condition of life in a world that has gone through an age of exuberance but now confronts a carrying capacity deficit. Pre-climax community. Any community subject to succession because its collective use of the site is not self-compensating and the characteristics of the site are changed by that community's life processes, so the site becomes less suited to supporting the existing association of organisms and more suited to supporting a changed association. Pre-ecological thoughtways. See Cornucopian paradigm. Cornucopian paradigm. A view of the past and future human progress that disregards the carrying capacity concept, pays no attention to the finiteness of the world or to differences between takeover and drawdown, and accepts uncritically the myth of limitlessness. Production. In ecology, the fixation of energy by photosynthesis, or the construction of energy-rich organic matter from energy-poor abiotic substances by photosynthetic action. Prosthetic device. In medical practice, an artificial substitute for a part of the body, as for example an artificial limb. By extension, any artificial device or any other thing that either serves as a function some organ would otherwise serve or enables an organism to do something it could not otherwise do without having developed a special organ for the purpose. Quasi-speciation. The non-genetic differentiation of a human population into differently specialized subgroups by use of alternative tools, customs, or symbols. Realism. Recognition that the age of exuberance is over, and that overpopulation and resource depletion must inexorably change human organization and human behavior. Recycling. The natural return of substances from the end of the food chain to the beginning. Through the actions of decomposers, by extension, the artificial processes in which previously used materials are reused. Redundancy anxiety. A morbid apprehension arising from population pressure, based on the more or less conscious realization that if there is an excess of population in relation to carrying capacity, the population surplus may include oneself, not just others. Renewable resources. Usable substances produced by ongoing processes such as organic growth that takes place at rates commensurate with actual or potential rates of consumption. Also usable energy obtained directly or indirectly from contemporary solar inputs, rather than withdrawn from finite quantities accumulated from past solar inputs. Resources. Materials or energy sources usable by organisms. Not only the characteristics of the materials or sources, but also the traits of the organism and its equipment will determine which materials or sources are usable. Respiration. Chemical reactions in organisms by which energy in organic molecules is made available for use, mainly through oxidation of carbon compounds. Selection pressure. The favoring of one variant over another by its more advantageous adaptation to environmental circumstances, measured by differential rates of replacement. Seral stages. the developmental stages in a process of community succession. Seer, the entire sequence of community types that tend to succeed each other on a given type of site. Speciation, differentiation of a population into distinct types that do not interbreed and that have genetically produced traits adapted to different environmental conditions. Species, a category of organisms taxonomists have judged to be sufficiently distinct from others for recognition as a separate kind, assumed or known to be incapable of interbreeding with other species. Standing crop, see biomass. Biomass, the amount of living material in a specified context. Subdominant, noun, a species with significant but less than first rank influence upon the characteristics of its habitat and upon other species sharing that habitat. Adjective, having less than first rank influence. Subspecies, a partially differentiated subpopulation still capable of interbreeding with other subpopulations of the same species, for example, a race. Succession, an orderly and directional process of community change resulting from modification of the habitat by the community and culminating in a maximally stable ecosystem relative to the characteristics of the site. Sustained yield, the result of balance between rates of harvest and rates of growth and replacement, so that the resource is not destroyed by overuse. Related to the term usufruct, although that term is not used in this book. Symbiosis, mutual dependence of populations of differentiated organisms. Symbiotic, mutually interdependent, especially in the positive sense of mutually beneficial. Takeoff. In economics, the point in the history of a society at which its economic surplus is sufficient to permit continual reinvestment in economic growth so that growth becomes self-sustaining. Takeover method of enlarging carrying capacity. Increasing opportunities for one species by reducing opportunities for competing species. Technology. Either the systematic study and knowledge of the means of making and using devices for implementing the attainment of goals or the devices themselves. Temporary carrying capacity. Combination of actual carrying capacity and phantom carrying capacity. The population that a habitat can support for a short time only, until the supply of some exhaustible resource upon which that species has become dependent runs out. Territoriality. An animal behavior pattern that commonly arises in response to actual or potential resource shortages. Individuals or groups lay claim to distinct territories for feeding or breeding, drive off non-claimants, and thereby ensure that scarce resources will adequately support claimants rather than being spread too thinly among an excessive population. Trade acreage. The additional farmland a given nation would need in order to supply the net portion of food or fuel it obtains by trade with other nations. Vilification, reviling or defaming other individuals or groups, imputing to supposed villains major responsibility for evil developments. Visible acreage, the farmland, forests, and pastures within a nation's own borders, which it recognizes as the source of products it consumes, or as the source of commodities it trades for imports it consumes. Web of life, the total network of cooperative, competitive, and predatory relationships between organisms struggling for existence in a common and finite habitat. The following post by John Michael Greer on his blog, The Archdruid Report, is from Wednesday, February 4th, 2015. A few days before this, I called him and let him know that Bill Catton had died and asked him if he'd consider writing a tribute post. And he said he normally doesn't do that, but he did. And this is the post. As night closes in. I was saddened to learn a few days ago, by a phone call from a fellow author, that William R. Catton Jr. died early last month, just short of his 89th birthday. Some of my readers will have no idea who he was. Others may dimly recall that I've mentioned him and his most important book, Overshoot, repeatedly in these essays. Those who've taken the time to read the book just named may be wondering why none of the sites in the Peak Oil blogosphere has put up an obituary, or even noted the man's passing. I don't happen to know the answer to that last question, though I have my suspicions. I encountered Overshoot for the first time in a college bookstore in Bellingham, Washington, in 1983. Red letters on a stark yellow spine spelled out the title, a word I already knew about from my classes in ecology and systems theory. I pulled it off the shelf and found the future staring me in the face. This is what's on the cover, the front cover, below the title. Carrying capacity. Maximum permanently supportable load. Cornucopian myth. Euphoric belief in limitless resources. Drawdown. Stealing resources from the future. Cargoism. Delusion that technology will always save us from overshoot. Growth beyond an area's carrying capacity, leading to crash, die-off. If you want to know where I got the core ideas I've been exploring in these essays for the last 8 going on 9 years, in other words, now you know. I still have that copy of Overshoot. It's sitting on the desk in front of me right now, reminding me yet again just how many chances we had to turn away from the bleak future that's closing in around us now, like the night at the end of a long day. Plenty of books in the 1970s and early 1980s applied the lessons of ecology to the future of industrial civilization and picked up at least part of the bad news that results. Overshoot was arguably the best of the lot, but it was pretty much guaranteed to land even deeper in the memory hole than the others. The difficulty was that Catton's book didn't pander to the standard mythologies that still beset any attempt to make sense of the predicament we've made for ourselves. It provides no encouragement to what he called cargoism, the claim that technological progress will inevitably allow us to have our planet and eat it too, without falling off the other side of the balance into the sort of apocalyptic daydreams that Hollywood loves to make into bad movies. Instead, in calm, crisp, thoughtful prose, he explained how industrial civilization was cutting its own throat, how far past the point of no return we'd already gone, and what had to be done in order to salvage anything from the approaching wreck. As I noted in a post here in 2011, and parenthetically, that post was what alerted me to William Catton and had me buy the book when I read it aloud to Connie, and I only read it a month earlier than this, and that's also basically when William Catton died. So as noted in a post here in 2011, I had the chance to meet Catton at an ASPO conference and tried to give him some idea of how much his book had meant to me. I did my best not to act like a 14-year-old fan meeting a rock star, but I'm by no means sure that I succeeded. We talked for 15 minutes over dinner. He was very gracious. Then things moved on. Each of us left the conference to carry on with our lives, and now he's gone. As the old song says, that's the way it goes. There's so much more that could be said about William Catton, but that task should probably be left for someone who knew the man as a teacher, scholar, and a human being. I didn't, except for that one 15-minute conversation. I knew him solely as the mind behind one of the books that helped me make sense of the world and then kept me going on the long desert journey through the Reagan era, when most of those who claimed to be environmentalists over the previous decade cashed in their ideals and waved around the cornucopian myth as their excuse for that act. Thus, I am simply going to urge all of my readers who haven't yet read Overshoot to do so as soon as possible, even if they have to crawl on their bare hands and knees over abandoned fracking equipment to get a copy. Having said that, I'd like to go on to the sort of tribute I think he would have appreciated most, an attempt to take certain of his ideas a little further than he did. The core of Overshoot, which is also the core of the entire world of appropriate technology and green alternatives that got shot through the head and shoved into an unmarked grave in the Reagan years, is the recognition that the principles of ecology apply to industrial society just as much as they do communities of living things. It's odd, all things considered, that this is such a controversial proposal. Most of us have no trouble grasping the fact that the law of gravity affects human beings the same way it affects rocks. Most of us understand that other laws of nature really do apply to us. But quite a few of us seem to be incapable of extending the same sensible reasoning to one particular set of laws, the ones that govern how communities of living things relate to their environments. If people treated gravity the way that they treat ecology, you could visit a news website any day of the week and read someone insisting with a straight face that while it's true that rocks fall down when dropped, human beings don't. No. No, they fall straight up into the sky, and anyone who thinks otherwise is so obviously wrong, there's no point even discussing the matter. That degree of absurdity appears every single day in the American media, and in ordinary conversations as well, whenever ecological issues come up. Suggest that a finite planet must by definition contain a finite amount of fossil fuels, that dumping billions of tons of gaseous trash into the air every single year for centuries might change the way the atmosphere retains heat, or that the law of diminishing returns might apply to technology the same way it applies to everything else, and you can pretty much count on being shouted down by those who, for all practical purposes, might as well believe that the world is flat. Still, as part of the ongoing voyage into the unspeakable in which this blog is currently engaged, I'd like to propose that, in fact, human societies are as subject to the laws of ecology as they are to every other dimension of natural law. That act of intellectual heresy implies certain conclusions that are acutely unwelcome in most circles just now. Still, as my regular readers will have noticed long ago, that's just one of the services this blog offers. Let's start with the basics. Every ecosystem in thermodynamic terms is a process by which relatively concentrated energy is dispersed into diffuse background heat. Here on Earth, at least, the concentrated energy mostly comes from the sun, in the form of solar radiation. There are a few ecosystems in deep oceans and underground that get their energy from chemical reactions driven by the Earth's internal heat instead. Ilya Prigogine showed some decades back that the flow of energy through a system of this sort tends to increase the complexity of the system. Jeremy England, an MIT physicist, has recently shown that the same process accounts neatly for the origin of life itself. The steady flow of energy from source to sink is the foundation on which everything else rests. The complexity of the system, in turn, is limited by the rate at which energy flows through the system, and this, in turn, depends on the difference in concentration between the energy that enters the system, on the one hand, and the background into which waste heat diffuses when it leaves the system, on the other. That shouldn't be a difficult concept to grasp. Not only is it basic thermodynamics, it's basic physics. It's precisely equivalent, in fact, to pointing out that the rate at which water flows through any section of a stream depends on the difference in height between the place where the water flows into that section and the place where it flows out. Simple as it is, it's a point that an astonishing number of people, including some who are scientifically literate, routinely miss. A while back on this blog, for example, I noted that one of the core reasons you can't power a modern industrial civilization on solar energy is that sunlight is relatively diffuse as an energy source compared to the extremely concentrated energy we get from fossil fuels. And the previous blog post that he hotlinks is from Wednesday, February 24th, 2010, the title, Energy Follows Its Bliss. I still field rants from people insisting that this is utter hogwash, since photons have exactly the same amount of energy they did when they left the sun, and so the energy they carry is just as concentrated as it was when it left the sun. You'll notice, though, that if this was the only variable that mattered, Neptune would be just as warm as Mercury, since each of the photons hitting the one planet pack on average the same energetic punch as those that hit the other. It's hard to think of a better example of the blindness to whole systems that's pandemic in today's geek culture. Obviously, the difference between the temperatures of Neptune and Mercury isn't a function of the energy of individual photons hitting the two worlds. It's a function of differing concentrations of photons, the number of them, let's say, hitting a square meter of each planet's surface. This is also one of the two figures that matter when we're talking about solar energy here on Earth. The other? That's the background heat into which waste energy disperses when the system, eco or solar, is done with it. On the broadest scale, that's deep space, but ecosystems don't funnel their waste heat straight up into orbit, you know. Rather, they diffuse it into the ambient temperature at whatever height above or below sea level, and whatever latitude closer or further from the equator they happen to be. And since that's heated by the sun too, the difference between input and output concentrations isn't very substantial. Nature has done astonishing things with that very modest difference in concentration. People who insist that photosynthesis is horribly inefficient, and of course we can improve its efficiency, are missing a crucial point. Something like half the energy that reaches the leaves of a green plant from the sun is put to work lifting water from the roots by an ingenious form of evaporative pumping, in which water sucked out through the leaf pores as vapor draws up more water through a network of tiny tubes in the plant's stems. Another few percent goes into the manufacture of sugars by photosynthesis and a variety of minor processes, such as the chemical reactions that ripen fruit, also depend to some extent on light or heat from the sun. All told, a green plant is probably about as efficient in its total use of solar energy as the laws of thermodynamics will permit. What's more, the Earth's ecosystems take the energy that flows through the green engines of plant life and put it to work in an extraordinary diversity of ways. The water pumped into the sky by what botanists call evapotranspiration, that's the evaporative pumping I mentioned a moment ago, plays critical roles in local, regional, and global water cycles. The production of sugars to store solar energy in chemical form kicks off an even more intricate set of changes, as the plant's cells are eaten by something, which is eaten by something, and so on through the lively but precise dance of the food web. Eventually, all the energy the original plant scooped up from the sun turns into diffuse waste heat and permeates slowly up through the atmosphere to its ultimate destiny, warming some corner of deep space a bit above absolute zero. But by the time it gets there, it's usually had quite a ride. That said, there are hard upper limits to the complexity of the ecosystem that these intricate processes can support. You can see that clearly enough by comparing a tropical rainforest to a polar tundra. The two environments may have approximately equal amounts of precipitation over the course of a year. They may have an equally rich or poor supply of nutrients in the soil. Even so, the tropical rainforest can easily support 15 or 20,000 species of plants and animals, and the tundra will be lucky to support a few hundred. Why? The same reason Mercury is warmer than Neptune, the rate at which photons from the sun arrive in each place per square meter of surface. Near the equator, the sun's rays fall almost vertically. Close to the poles, since the Earth is round, the sun's rays come in at a sharp angle and thus are spread out over more surface area. The ambient temperature is quite a bit warmer in the rainforest than it is on the tundra. But because the vast heat engine we call the atmosphere pumps heat from the equator to the poles, the difference in ambient temperature is not as great as the difference in solar input per cubic meter. Thus, ecosystems near the equator have a greater difference in energy concentration between input and output than those near the poles, and the complexity of the two systems varies accordingly. All this should be common knowledge. Of course, it isn't, because the industrial world's notions of education consistently ignore what William Catton called the processes that matter, that is, the fundamental laws of ecology that frame our existence on this planet, and approach a great many of those subjects that do make it into the curriculum in ways that encourage the most embarrassing sort of ignorance about the natural processes that keep us all alive. I'm going to say that again. All this should be common knowledge. Of course it isn't, because the industrial world's notions of education consistently ignore what William Catton called the processes that matter, that is, the fundamental laws of ecology that frame our existence on this planet, and approach a great many of those subjects that do make it into the curriculum in ways that encourage the most embarrassing sort of ignorance about the natural processes that keep us all alive. Down the road a bit, we'll be discussing that in much more detail. For now, though, I want to take the points just made and apply them systematically, in much the way Catton did, to the predicament of industrial civilization. A human society is an ecosystem. Like any other ecosystem, it depends for its existence on flows of energy. And as with any other ecosystem, the upper limit on its complexity depends ultimately on the difference in concentration between the energy that enters it and the background into which its waste heat disperses. This last point is a corollary of White's Law, one of the fundamental principles of human ecology, which holds that a society's economic development is directly proportional to its consumption of energy per capita. Until the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that upper limit was not much higher than the upper limit of complexity in other ecosystems, since human ecosystems drew most of their energy from the same sources as non-human ones, sunlight falling on green plants. As human societies figured out how to tap other flows of solar energy, wind power to drive windmills and send ships coursing over the seas, water power to turn mills, and so on, that upper limit crept higher, but not dramatically so. The discoveries that made it possible to turn fossil fuels into mechanical energy transformed that equation completely. The geological processes that stockpiled 500 million years of sunlight into coal, oil, and natural gas boosted the concentration of the energy inputs available to industrial societies by an almost unimaginable factor, without warming the ambient temperature of the planet more than a few degrees, and the huge differentials in energy concentration that resulted drove an equally unimaginable increase in complexity. Choose any measure of complexity you wish. Number of discrete occupational categories, average number of human beings involved in the production, distribution, and consumption of any given good or service, or what have you. And in the wake of the Industrial Revolution, it soared right off the charts. Thermodynamically, that's exactly what you'd expect. The difference in energy concentration between input and output, it bears repeating, defines the upper limit of complexity. Other variables determine whether or not the system in question will achieve that upper limit. In the ecosystems we call human societies, knowledge is one of those other variables. If you have a highly concentrated energy source and don't yet know how to use it efficiently, your society isn't going to become as complex as it otherwise could. Over the 3 centuries of industrialization, as a result, the production of useful knowledge was a winning strategy, since it allowed industrial societies to rise steadily toward the upper limit of complexity defined by the concentration differential. The limit was never reached. The law of diminishing returns saw to that. And so, inevitably, industrial societies ended up believing that knowledge all by itself was capable of increasing the complexity of the human ecosystem. Since there's no upper limit to knowledge, in turn, that belief system drove what Catton called the cornucopian myth, the delusion that there would always be enough resources if only the stock of knowledge increased quickly enough. That belief only seemed to work, though, as long as the concentration differential between energy inputs and the background remained very high. Once easily accessible fossil fuels started to become scarce, and more energy and other resources had to be invested in the extraction of what remained, problems started to crop up. Tar sands and oil shales in their natural form are not as concentrated an energy source as light, sweet crude. Once they're refined, sure, the differences are minimal, but a whole system analysis of energy concentration has to start at the moment each energy source enters the system. Take a cubic yard of tar sand fresh from the pit mine with the sand still in it, or a cubic yard of oil shale with the oil still trapped into the rock, and you've simply got less energy per unit volume than you do if you've got a cubic yard of light sweet crude fresh from the well, or even a cubic yard of good permeable sandstone with light sweet crude oozing out of every pore. It's an article of faith in contemporary culture that such differences don't matter, but that's just another aspect of our cornucopian myth. The energy needed to get the sand out of the tar sands or the oil out of the shale oil has to come from somewhere, and that energy in turn is not available for other uses. The result, however you slice it conceptually, is that the upper limit of complexity begins moving down. That sounds abstract, but it adds up to a great deal of very concrete misery. because, as already noted, the complexity of a society determines such things as the number of different occupational specialties it can support, the number of employees who are involved in the production and distribution of any given good or service, and so on. There's a useful phrase for a sustained contraction in the usual measures of complexity in a human ecosystem: economic depression. The economic troubles that are shaking the industrial world more and more often these days, in other words, are symptoms of a disastrous mismatch between the level of complexity that our remaining concentration differential can support and the level of complexity that our preferred ideologies insist we ought to have. As those two things collide, there's no question which one of them is going to win. Adding to our total stock of knowledge won't change that result, since knowledge is a necessary condition for economic expansion, but not a sufficient one. If the upper limit of complexity set by the laws of thermodynamics drops below the level that your knowledge base would otherwise support, further additions to the knowledge base simply mean that there will be a growing number of things that people know how to do in theory, but that nobody has the resources to do in practice. Knowledge, in other words, is not a magic wand, a surrogate messiah, or a source of miracles. It can open the way to exploiting energy more efficiently than otherwise, and it can figure out how to use energy resources that were not previously being used at all, but it can't conjure energy out of thin air. Even if the energy resources are there, for that matter, if other factors prevent them from being used, the knowledge of how they might be used offers no consolation. Quite the contrary. That latter point, I think, sums up the tragedy of William Catton's career. He knew and could explain with great clarity why industrialism would bring about its own downfall, and what could be done to salvage something from its wreck. That knowledge, however, was not enough to make things happen. Only a few people ever listened. Most of them promptly plugged their ears and started chanting, "La la la, I can't hear you," once Reagan made that fashionable. And the actions that might have spared all of us a vast amount of misery never happened. When I spoke to him in 2011, he was perfectly aware that his life's work had done essentially nothing to turn industrial society aside from its rush toward the abyss. That's got to be a bitter thing to contemplate in your final hours. And I hope his thoughts were on something else last month as the night closed in at last. This next tribute was written by Kurt Cobb. It's William Catton's warning. William Catton, Jr., author of the seminal volume about our human destiny, Overshoot, the Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change, died last month at age 88. Catton believed that industrial civilization has sown the seeds of its own demise and that humanity's seeming dominance of the biosphere is only a prelude to decline. His work foreshadowed later works such as Joseph Tainter's The Collapse of Complex Societies, Richard Heinberg's The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and Jared Diamond's Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Survive. In Overshoot, Catton wrote, quote, "We must learn to relate personally to what may be called the ecological facts of life. We must see that those facts are affecting our lives far more importantly and permanently than the events that make the headlines," unquote. He published those words in 1980, and now it seems at least some of those facts have made their way into the headlines in the form of climate change, soil erosion, fisheries collapse, species extinction, constrained supplies of energy and other critical resources, and myriad other problems that are now all too obvious. But even today, few people see the world as Catton did. Few realize how serious these problems are and how their consequences are unfolding right before us. Few understand what he called the tragic story of human success. Tragic because that success, as it is currently defined, cannot be maintained and must necessarily unwind into decline owing to the laws of physics and the realities of biology. We can adjust to these realities, or they will adjust us to them. Perhaps the single keenest insight Catton had is that humans have become detritivores, organisms that live off the dead remains of other organisms. By this he meant the human dependence on fossil fuels, which are the ancient dead remains of organisms transformed into oil, natural gas, and coal. It is the fate of detritivore populations to expand and contract with their supply of detritus. He likened modern humans to algae feeding on the rich supply of nutrients from dead organic matter swept into the pond by spring rains and often multiplying so as to cover the entire pond with a green carpet. By summer, with the rush of spring nutrients depleted, nutrients which are like the one-time infusion of fossil fuels into human society, the algae population crashes, leaving mostly open water and sometimes just an uneven ribbon along the edge of the pond. It's a boom-bust population cycle well known to biologists. In 1980, it seemed as if this cycle might be mitigated by wise policy and serious but achievable achievements in the human way of life. By 2009, when Catton published his other book, Bottleneck, Humanity's Impending Impasse, he felt that the time for major mitigation of the inevitable burst portion of the population cycle had passed. So why even write another book? Catton explained in the last paragraph of Bottleneck, quote, "I hope by the time my great-grandsons become great-grandfathers themselves, their generation will be so conspicuously more enlightened than mine was, and our forebears were that the world population of bottleneck survivors will have evolved social systems better able to be circumspect in their use of their planet and its vulnerable biosphere. If readers of this book come to share similar hopes and contribute to instilling them in their descendants, my reasons for writing will have been justified." This is a humble ambition compared to the cautious hope that flowed from Overshoot in 1980. And it is important to note Catton's emphasis on social systems, for he was trained as a sociologist. He believed that despite our considerable technical prowess, our social systems simply cannot contemplate making the drastic changes necessary to mitigate the downslope. Perhaps the most important thing to note about Catton is that he did not blame anyone for the human predicament. To him, that predicament is the natural outcome of evolutionary processes and the powers given to humans through those processes. That predicament is no more a product of conscious thought and intention than is the beating of our own hearts. When I met and chatted with him for the one and only time in 2006, he was mildly jocular in the same way that his writing is, and he was upbeat in his attitude toward daily life, however disturbing the future may seem. That was probably the product of a life spent in deep and patient study of the world around him, a world that yielded some of its most hidden and important secrets to him. And he had the satisfaction of having published those secrets so that they would not be secrets anymore. Overshoot may stand as the central text of the 20th century about the ecological fate of humankind. The book represents a missed opportunity in that so few people were able to hear what Catton had to say in 1980, and so few want to hear it now, even as the headlines are filled with the very precursors of the bottleneck he laments in his last major piece of writing. And this was published back in 2010, January 31st, 2010, also by Kurt Cobb, titled The Bottleneck Century. In his documentary, What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire, filmmaker Tim Bennett notes that many of the book's authors now writing about peak oil, climate change, species extinction, and myriad other urgent environmental and resource topics usually end their otherwise grim analyses with what he calls the happy chapter, a chapter with solutions and responses which will supposedly help us to avert catastrophe. In a new book, Bottleneck, Humanity's Impending Impasse, William Catton Jr. dispenses with the happy chapter altogether and simply gives us the grim prognosis. Human society is now on an unstoppable trajectory for a significant die-off. Catton, author of the well-known classic of human ecology, Overshoot, expects that by 2100 the world population will be smaller, perhaps much smaller, than it is today. We are in what he calls the bottleneck century. He likens our situation to that of an airplane taking off at nighttime with a crew that is unaware that the runway is too short. The pilot will accelerate the plane as usual, expecting a normal takeoff. Unless the pilot somehow receives and believes a warning to brake and reverse the engines quickly, by the time he or she actually sees the end of the runway, it will be too late and the plane will crash. Well, the warnings have been issued, Catton explains, and few people believe them. Catton spends much of the book explaining why this is so. As you read his explanation, it becomes clear why there will be no happy chapter at the end. The main culprit, according to Catton, is the division of labor into ever smaller occupational niches. The marvel of such a system is that people who know nothing about one another's occupation can cooperate through the miracle of the marketplace to increase society's overall productivity and wealth. And they can exchange every kind of good or service through the medium of money. The downside is such a complex and finely differentiated system is that no one can really understand it. That might not matter so much, except that fossil fuels have enabled humans to increase both their numbers and per capita consumption enormously in the last 200 years. The impact of that vast increase on the world's renewable and non-renewable resources has been profound. It has led to all the effects mentioned above and many others, including deforestation, heavy erosion of farmland, toxic pollution of air and water, and overfishing, over-harvesting of fisheries. But how does our complex division of labor make it more difficult to respond to these problems? First, we cannot make an independent appraisal of these problems because of our limited knowledge, mostly confined to our occupational niches. As a result, we must rely on experts. This leads to the second difficulty. We are often faced with competing opinions among experts. Never mind that some of these experts are merely paid spokespersons for the fossil fuel industry or for big agribusiness or for the forestry industry. Without careful discernment, most of the public has difficulty differentiating scientifically based statements from mere polemic and outright falsehood. The mass media thus becomes a conduit for propagating bad or at least inconclusive information. In short, the feedback we humans need in order to run our society in a sustainable way is dangerously lacking. Because language is the way humans coordinate much of their activity, especially in our complex society of highly differentiated occupations, when that language becomes corrupted or is used to deceive, it works against the survivability of the species. One problem is that we have outdated word maps, which tell us, for instance, that natural resource extraction is really production, and can therefore be expanded as necessary whenever we like. And we believe we can throw things away, when there really never has been any away. We throw away our carbon emissions into the atmosphere and produce global warming. We throw away our toxic chemicals into landfills, which then leak into our waterways. Third, since nearly all humans now labor in exceedingly narrow occupational niches, they seek to maintain those niches by competing with others. The famed sociologist Emil Durkheim hypothesized that division of labor would create solidarity among humans through interdependence. Instead, it has created the alienation and competition that go hand in hand with the dominance of the market system in nearly every economic transaction. Most humans now believe their lives are about acquiring money rather than resources, since for so many, money is the only gateway to the resources they need. This financializes their thinking and makes it difficult to talk about Earth systems in some other context than the market. Fourth, human beings evolve in response to current conditions, not future ones. Humans are known to discount possible future events greatly. This puts their focus on what they are experiencing right now and makes them vulnerable to large, abrupt changes, since their inclination to prepare for future changes is exceedingly limited. The competitive and impersonal nature of modern society, the corruption of language and control of mass communication by vested interests, and the focus of humans on the here and now combine to make it all but impossible to coordinate human efforts worldwide in the thoroughgoing way that would be required to avoid the bottleneck. Those efforts would have to include an immediate drop in fertility rates below replacement, a vast reduction in the consumption of natural resources, and the complete abandonment of the burning of fossil fuels. You can see why Catton thinks such developments must be placed in the impossible category. None of these main points are dealt with systematically in the book, but appear and reappear in various contexts. Catton could have used an editor to help him organize his message and make it more succinct and focused. For example, the many personal anecdotes sprinkled throughout the text seem as if they could have been eliminated or at least been written more sharply. The failure of style in this book may result from it being self-published, but I can understand Catton's urgency. At 84, he may have felt that he didn't want to wait to line up a regular publisher. Still, despite Catton's discursive style, the reader will be rewarded with his subtle insights into the nexus between nature and human society. Rather than giving us a catalog of our depleted resources, our poisoned water, food and air, or the data behind our endangered climate, he assumes all of this and tells us why human beings are unlikely to respond to these problems and therefore seem almost certain to face a bottleneck in this century. For those who have read his marvelous book, Overshoot, this new book will not seem as challenging as it otherwise might be. Bottleneck ends with a disheartening message, for it suggests that there is no alternative but to prepare for the bottleneck. Catton is nevertheless explicit about the advantages of knowing the worst rather than living in any temporary blissful ignorance. He does not believe humans will be wiped out, but rather that their numbers will be considerably reduced and their societies simplified. If his book contributes to some form of ecological awareness that can be transmitted beyond the bottleneck, Michael, I'm looking at you, then he says he will consider it a success. It's an oddly humble objective for a book so sweeping in its conclusions.